Just have yourself sitting and maybe having an amorphous sense of your body. You know, it's just maybe just a warm collective sense of itself rather than, you know, its individual parts and areas of discomfort. And I feel like that's a launching point just to hone in on tranquility. Pasadi, if you like, in the Pali, Kaya Pasadi, tranquility of the body. There's a great emphasis on that, and it's also the causal condition to give rise to the deeper sukha or happiness that we can experience in meditation, which is the rapture and happiness that is of a deeper sense that can take us deeper into our meditation practice. It's born of tranquility. But I guess in terms of our meditation practice, I also like to challenge the idea that you have to sit for hours to tranquilize yourself or to experience tranquility. And it's one of the things I used to play around with when I was a monk. With, if I had limited time before a meal, or, you know, I think I used to mention to you people, I would sometimes skip up to the little library up the spiral staircase in the back of the Dhamma hall when I was a bit early from my hut, but I didn't want to go down to the Dhanasala yet. And I would just go up there quietly. It was like my little secret place, and I would, you know, maybe have 5 minutes or something. And, you know, I might look for a book or something that I was interested in, or maybe a phrase, or you know, like talking about today, the causal conditions for things. So the causal conditions for Kaya Pasadi is giving rise to sukha. It's one of those things in the Anguttara Nikaya. So I might just have a contemplation and then I'd look for it. But I would also try to just sit quietly for 5 minutes and just see how deep I could go in my meditation practice or how much happiness I could access. And it's one of the things I probably haven't put enough emphasis on in my own practice now that I've left the monastery, but one of the things that we can focus on in our meditation practice is the tranquility. And a practical way that we can sort of observe that is when we say watching our breath, and we see how tranquil we can allow the breath to become. We can allow it to slow down. To may not even become so distinguishable. And in my very early practice, I noticed, and I used a bit of forcefulness, and it was very different to how Ajahn Brahm teaches now. I think I mentioned complex counting technique. It was my introduction to meditation from Ajahn Brahm. But one of the things I discovered for myself when I sat meditation was that if I could make or allow my in and out breath to become sort of indistinct from each other, so they had the same sort of qualitative experience between the two. So it was a feeling of having the breath rather than being like a, say, an up and down experience, or I just found like the breath became almost like a line of indistinguishable sensation. And, you know, that was a very personal sort of just observation, I guess you'd say, and it may not resonate with you. But I found that if I could allow my breath to become sort of very sort of tranquilized and indistinguishable between the in and out breath, it's just like a stream of very, very gentle breathing. I could sustain myself there for a significant amount of time. And while I was there, I would feel, you know, pleasure and happiness, and I would find my meditation practice, like, you know, deeply satisfying, have interesting experiences. And so once I observed that, then that's, you know, how I would practice. To I would be able to just close my eyes and access that space whenever I chose to do so, which was a great gift for me. And yeah, maybe something that I've overlooked later on in practice, where I've, you know, embraced metta and other practices. But it was a very basic sort of breakthrough I had, very deep, and in terms of what it was enabled me to do in my meditation practice. And that tranquilizing or allowing our breath to just slow down is very, very interesting. And you can, as you're able to, and I used to push it, and as I said, I used too much force. But I don't have any of those issues anymore. So when I was able to just tune into my, allow my breath just to tranquilize, you know, the physical sensations in the body will become, like I mentioned, you know, very soft and pleasurable, and a lot of anxiety or built up stress and tension or sickness that I've had, I can find will reduce. And it was just a great reflection on that tranquility that we can sort of allow to happen in our practice. And it's that real process of like allowing ourselves to slow down and just to allow us to just see how slowly things can sort of grind down. And it almost feels like, you know, a little like you approach suspended animation. I remember one of my fellow monastics describing it as like sort of, you felt like when he was meditating, his good meditation felt like sort of breathing underwater. And, you know, that's an interesting way. It's, you know, I have the observation that when I allowed the breath to become very tranquil, it became a great sense of ease with that. You know, might not be actually breathing overly much, but when you're just sitting there and meditating, we don't have great, you know, demands for oxygen and whatnot. And we can just allow our body and mind just to become ever so tranquil. And obviously with our meditative awareness, we know we don't drift off to sleep. But, you know, that's one of the things that can be an obstacle initially as we approach tranquility when sati is not enough. And I think it's normal for new meditators. I know that I would emerge from what I thought was a deep meditation session after an hour and a half or something and find like a pool of drool on my robe where I was being nodding off and, you know, have interesting visions and things, but it was all like, you know, there's a Thai word for that, moha samadhi, diluted concentration. But it's very pleasant. You can sort of become quite, or the, I don't know if it would qualify as the, what they call bhavanga or whatnot, but it's you'd sort of be able to access this tranquilized state, but there wouldn't be sati there. So I'm not really, you know, talking about that, but it's a really it's just a very, very solid awareness as the body and mind is becoming more and more tranquil. And the quality of that awareness only really improves as we allow ourselves to become more and more tranquil, because it just becomes brighter and gives rise to, you know, potentially like nimittas or even or signs of the mind, as Ajahn Brahm would say. But as we allow our breath to become ever so tranquil, you know, some teachers even refer to like a mental image of the breath. And but it certainly gives rise to that mental feeling of like pleasure and happiness. And it's really born of tranquility and calming. So, you know, I just wanted to emphasize emphasize tranquility today. And even like approaching something like loving kindness or any other meditation object from that point of view of just allowing things to tranquilize to a certain degree first, you'll find a different qualitative quality that you can then bring to the table when you introduce a meditative, you know, switch. So, for example, I might, you know, an example would be just for this evening when I was watching my breath and then became quite tranquil and then just a little bit of loving kindness. It's, the mind is always very receptive there and can give rise to very pleasant feelings and perceptions. That's obviously a real glue for us in our meditation practice to sustain and to want to do it again. When it's comfortable and pleasurable, it's something that we want to visit again and again. And it's just also very, very much a resource for us to access when we have to deal with pain and stress and loss and sickness. I've had some challenges myself recently having COVID. And you can probably still hear my voice a bit funny. And I wasn't overly sick, but it was a difficult time. I had to have one of my cats euthanized as well during that period. She was very, very sick and in a lot of pain, which would probably be another another topic. But certainly it helped me be able to really come into when I wanted to meditate, just to be able to access sort of happiness as simply and as obstacle-free as possible. So it was a good in terms of its impact on my meditative practice, to both be sick and to have that sense of loss, I guess, because I often like to experiment and try different, you know, like for health as well, like to do some breathing techniques and things like that. But this, like, really at the core of our practice is just allowing things to settle, just to be able to allow ourselves to become tranquil and be able to access happiness. And sometimes you just want to be able to do that in the most direct route as possible. And ultimately, it's for each of one of us to be able to find that technique and strategy that works for us and enables us to approach that. And, you know, it really is, you know, I've sort of shared some practical sort of breakthroughs, I guess, that have guided my practice. But it's very much sort of like something that you have to find out for yourself. And that's, you know, quite probably idiosyncratic to me. But, you know, you might be able to sort of also have a sense of what I'm talking about and be able to relate to that in your own way. I think it's ultimately we have guidance by good teachers, and, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have met a lot of wonderful teachers as well, having Ajahn Brahm. But ultimately we need to be able to guide ourselves and be that resource for ourselves and find strategies and approaches that work for us and allow us to become free of our discursive mind and be able to access happiness. And some of that is having skillful means, others having insights and breakthroughs in terms of our personality and seeing what obstacles we put between ourselves and our meditation object. Obviously, developing samatha, calming and samadhi, you know, you're going to develop insight into your own unique sort of take on the kalesa. Your own particular unique combination of greed, hatred, and delusion, and views and opinions that may get in your way of accessing happiness, and obviously sickness and illness and death and loss, and worldwide pandemics and all that can bring some stuff up for us, which, you know, can be a teacher for us. So. I guess that's wanting to be my main just reflection for people today. But again, I always want to encourage everyone as well to develop loving kindness. I think having emotional intelligence for yourself and others is always really, really supportive of practice. And as much as that's important in the monastic setting when you're living in a community of people from all around the world, different cultures and misunderstandings can arise potentially, even though the monks' vinaya and the monks' rules are sort of very much guided towards peaceful and harmonious interaction. You still get issues in monastic settings, and sometimes people leave out of, you know, maybe having ill will or being fed up with the teacher or having disputes with others. So even these things can happen in the monastic setting. But even more so in the community that we're in, and the online social media and everything that we have to face with, it's, you know, even greater demands for having some loving kindness for ourselves and others, and just general kindness and patience in our interactions. And really that's, you know, that's how I like to see that you're hitting quite a few numbers of the path when you're cultivating the Brahmaviharas, like loving kindness. You're doing right thought, you've got right action, usually it will probably guide your livelihood as well. You have all these factors of the path that are sort of ticked when you, you know, the virtue path can be covered when you've developed kindness. And obviously it's a great platform for developing meditation and having that insight that maybe we're not the center of the universe, and to respect and make other people's paths as pleasant as possible for them as well, or as, you know, be helpful and supportive. There's sort of like insights as well that we can develop. So I think in this world that, you know, you often hear spiritual teachings boiled down to that we're here to learn to love and to love each other. But I think it's not really a cliche. There's a great truth to that. And that's probably one of the unifying things for all different religions. And obviously it might not be as exciting for some people as other aspects of the path, whether you have a love of, you know, the suttas or, you know, conditioned arising or karma and all these interesting things, just the practical aspect of being a kind person and developing loving kindness is, you know, something that even monastics can overlook, and just wanted to encourage everyone today in their practice. And I'm very much learning still myself and trying to, my main challenge is always just trying to integrate meditation into lay life. And it's how many years? It's like I left, you know, almost 20 years ago, and it's still like my number one challenge. You know, I think I dined off my meditation experience in the monastery for the first few years of lay life, where I just felt significantly happy no matter what happened for a lot of the time, and then it slowly all faded. So yeah, it's challenging, and so I just want to give everyone a great sadhu for the effort that I put in, and just encourage everyone to keep going. Just keep putting one foot in front of the other mindfully. But yeah, thank you for listening. And I guess the next thing is we do like a guided meditation, but feel free to interject, or if anyone's got any suggestions or complaints or criticisms or... I'd just like to encourage everyone just to find a nice, comfortable spot. Sometimes there's a benefit to having a sense of a meditation posture. I think it sends a good signal to our mind and also to our body. Just coming into sense of appreciation of yourself sitting. Look for areas of wellness and comfort in the body. Some areas of the body might be feeling more soft and comfortable and expansive, or heavier, or lighter. Some perception that just lets us know that we have a sense of comfort. Just allowing that sense of comfort to spread throughout the whole body. And at this point, you may just like to check in with that spatial awareness of the body occupying space. So often of our, much of our day, we're just focused on the front side of our body, contacting space, and have a lot of stress and dynamics that play out there. Just by expanding our awareness just to include the sides of the body as well, you might find some of that dissipate and just have a different qualitative sense of itself. It's always nice to expand, feel more expansive, more spacious. You might also just want to allow that sense of your body occupying space just to become all-encompassing, include the back of you, the area behind you, to the sides, in front and above. Just really have a sense of your body feeling comfortable, feeling expansive, and just occupying space. I think it's a great antidote for tiredness and lethargy as well. And just see if you can maintain that sense of the, your posture, occupying space. You might have some interesting perceptions of expansion, contraction, or lightness, or heaviness that you associate with that sense of comfort and ease. You might observe that there's already a significant amount of tranquility now. And in the heart of this experience, you can just check into your breath. Just notice that it's already quite tranquil, it's quite light, quite effortless. Sometimes we have to have that sense of like the Ajahn Chah simile of the still forest pool. We just sort of sneak up on the breath without it noticing. We can catch it in its natural habitat. We can have that sense of, as we allow the breath to become more and more tranquil, our mind is becoming brighter, more radiant. And the awareness of that tranquil breath just supports that radiance for us. Hopefully we can have a sense of that tranquility of giving a rise to sukha, happiness. Something we can see for ourselves. as our breath becomes softer, we can notice our mind becoming softer. And just as we approach the end of our meditation, I'd just like to encourage people to introduce the thought of unconditional loving kindness. May all beings be well and happy. Putting that very softly into the center of our tranquility. Have a sense of that radiating in all those spatial directions at once. May all beings be well and happy. It's emanating from that softness and tranquility that we've been cultivating. And just in a gesture of appreciation and love, you might just want to just picture Ajahn Brahm and just wish, may Ajahn Brahm be well and happy. May Ajahn Brahm be well and happy. May each of us be well and happy. And just slowly start to anchor your sense of yourself in your body. Maybe slowly moving and just coming back to your room. Just in your own time. Just noticing how we feel and the benefits of meditation. The benefits of coming together with like-minded people.
It was a blissful meditation, Chris. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for joining me. Yeah, I feel like pretty happy to do some question and answers. I'm happy to ramble as well. If people's minds are too quiet to formulate any questions.
A nice peaceful ramble is always a nice way to spend the evening. So, but I'm sure we usually have some questions. So, does anybody have a question they would like to ask Chris?
Hey, this is Martha. I'm just wondering. It's interesting to think of the breath going in a straight line as one breath, the in and the out breath, as opposed to up and down. I don't know. I don't know. I would just like to hear more about that, if at all possible. Yeah, if there's techniques or you know, I would like to hear more of that because I experienced it. Because for years I just anchored it at the bottom of the breath. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, sure. I guess the origin of that for me was I had a really nice meditation one day, and then I tried to like recreate the causal conditions, which was somewhat misguided just because initially I would do so in a forceful way and keep my breath at a tranquility level that I wasn't really ready for. So I would get blissed out for a bit, but then it wasn't so much genuine tranquility. And then I would find myself having to take a few really deep breaths, like I'd been holding my breath or something. I was using willpower initially, but then I did discover that just if I allow the breath just to naturally get to that point rather than forcing it, it did become like that indistinguishable sense of qualitative breath moments, I guess, where instead of having the up and down of the beginning, the middle, the end of the breath, and pauses, and then the exhalation, and you know, maybe you know, I even remember one monk telling me that he thought that when meditation goes really well, you have these really long, slow, deep breaths, I guess trying to like impose a sort of complete yogic breath sense of it. But that wasn't my experience at all. It was when the breath becomes very gentle and refined and soft, and would just flow with the utmost ease, but just at a very tranquil and soft level. It just wouldn't have any, there wouldn't be any breaks in its quality, where at some point it would be harsh, or at some point it would, you know, be absent, or you know, it just became, I guess, instead of unruly, which is, you know, I think the unruliness is a result of us imposing ourselves onto the breath, and that's one of the drawbacks in hindsight of trying to go straight to the breath. Whereas that simile of, you know, sneaking up on the breath, like, you know, Ajahn Chah sitting very still by the still forest pool, all the creatures would come out and drink, and, you know, it's a simile for the mind, of course, nimitters and stuff. But if we can just, you know, sit very tranquilly, and then the breath is quite a difficult object, in that if you just try to hold on to whatever sense or understanding you have of the breath and just try to keep it at that point that you understand it, then you miss out on the opportunity for it to change and deepen. So one of the good things about Ajahn Brahm teaching that present moment awareness and stillness is then when you go to the breath, it's already very gentle and soft and tranquil. And then we can approach that sort of qualitative sense of the breath. And when it is subtle and has a real particular quality to it, and it doesn't have the ups and downs that we normally associate with our breathing pattern, it's much more approaching a mental image of the breath, will give rise to that nimitta and mental image of the breath and bliss, with just a natural ease that just emerges from it. But you know, we do have to be patient and allow the breath to get there naturally, rather than like as a young, you know, 21-year-old, 22-year-old, I would try to forcefully recreate that condition, you know, with some benefit to myself, because, you know, I would be like sort of shot out of a cannon or something. But then I couldn't sustain that sense of happiness. I'll go through cycles of doing that and then taking a couple of deep breaths. That was my first, you know, attempts at trying to replicate the conditions. But then I still remember it, actually. I was just, often my impromptu unorganized sits were could be really, really instrumental. And I was just washing my robes, and I think it was a sunny day, and I was in the ablutionary where everyone goes to the toilet, chops wood, washes robes. And I just sat on a stump outside the ablution block and remember meditating in the sun, and just found that sense of that breath, just tranquilizing to that point of, you know, quality, where the in and out breath would sort of emerge in this sort of same quality, each moment to moment to moment. If anything, the quality would slowly be enhancing itself over time, but it's obviously not something that we can rush. And normally I don't associate that ease with the breath. Normally when, you know, I focus on my breathing, have a sense of restriction or airway tightness, or you know, maybe wanting it to be deeper, or, you know, these normal perceptions of it, to the point where I've even done some yogic, you know, breath work and stuff just to try to understand. And there are some techniques in yoga that I listened to a talk, or a series of talks by a guy called Richard Freeman. And there's a way of approaching quality and comfort in the breath from that approach, but he's, you know, they don't even sustain their awareness in that manner. They will just do the breathing exercise for a certain amount of time, and then they'll go to stillness and let the breath emerge as it wants to emerge, which was quite interesting. But he would talk about qualities of, I guess the best way for me to tie it all together is just to give this little description of how he would describe it. He would describe the qualities of the in and out breath resonating within each other. So I never phrased it like that to myself, but it makes a lot of sense. He would talk about, say, for example, the quality of the in-breath being felt in the center of the heart. And I can still practice this technique and have pleasure arising from it. It is quite a nice technique. But he would like breathe in from his perineum area, to have a sense of the perineum, breathing into the chest and feeling the heart open. And the quality of the in-breath would be, you know, around that heart being uplifted and open. And then when he breathed out, he would encourage people to still have a sense of the quality of the in-breath and the out-breath by feeling the heart uplifted and open. And for me, that automatically gives rise to pleasure. Again, it's not something that I practiced at all today when we meditated. It was just an exercise, but I found it very interesting. And then he would talk about on the inhalation, being aware of the lower area of the body, like the pelvis and the perineal area, where the exhalation point sort of finishes. It was having a sense of whilst we inhale, we savour the essence of the exhalation. While we exhale, we savour the essence of the inhalation. Obviously, he goes on about this in some detail. So don't feel despondent if you think I'm talking craziness. If you don't have a sense of it, it took me a little while to get a sense of what he was talking about. But I feel that that's the more refined version of what he was hinting at, is in that subtle breathing that we were just talking about, where the inhalation and the exhalation, the quality of each are sort of contained in the other. And I would never have reflected on it like that. And it's could just be a mental construct. But he made that interesting observation. And certainly when I practice that technique and feel my, you know, airway, my heart opening with the inhalation. And then on the exhalation, I still feel the heart open and uplifted. It gives rise to a pleasant sense of the breath. So I thought that was just an interesting aside, really, more than anything. But certainly those qualities of the in and out breath can sort of, or the essence of each, could sort of be intermingled with each other, in terms of a qualitative sense of it. So that's, I think, you know, another way of approaching, you know, maybe that approach which he extols in looking for the quality of the other is, you know, in a way sort of merging them. But yeah, I don't know if that really completely answers your question, but it's just a reflection, I guess, on that quality. I really just put it down to a quality of the breath, and then it gives rise to a quality of the awareness, which then reinforces that breath. And that's why I'm sort of mentioned in the meditation about the radiance being supported by the tranquil breath, the radiant mind. And it's sort of like a feedback loop. So if you just go to the radiance in your mind and disregard the breath, and you're not nurturing the supportive condition for that continued radiance and deepening of that radiance, which is, you know, one of the things that we can do as our meditation deepens, we can latch onto the arising of the more pleasant phenomena, thinking that can be our meditation object now, but that's just an imita. It's not strong enough yet to sustain our awareness there. But it's that intermingling of the two which can generate the deepening of our practice and of our meditative experience that's so enticing and interesting when we get to that point. And can give, you know, rise to feelings of beauty and a sense of beauty in the breath and rapture and happiness and whatnot. So I just want to encourage people with that. And yeah, I mean, there's different ways of approaching it, but sometimes, and as I say, I do try these different things, and, you know, also for health benefit as well. Sometimes, you know, I feel like there's some health benefit to doing some of these breathing techniques that I was referring to. But ultimately, I look at Ajahn Brahm, who just sustains his health with just going to calmness and tranquility and samadhi. He doesn't look particularly healthy, but when I lived with him up in the monastery, he was the one who got the least sick out of everyone, and viruses and whatnot, except for his allergies, his hay fever. But even then, you know, he could tranquilize all that in his practice. And he's famous for not taking in any vitamins or going to the doctor. It's not maybe always the best approach, but I saw it for myself. He would just, when he's sick, he would just go and meditate. He would heal himself, and I think a lot of healing can just come from us being really tranquil and just going straight for the tranquility. Yeah, but thank you for that question. I know it's it's probably something that was not so conscious for me, but I was just trying to feel my way in my practice, and that was a major stepping stone for me.
Thank you, Chris. And Martha has left a comment for you. She says, yes, very helpful. I wrench the breath back to the nose. And she states she needs to expand to the heart and the belly. Now, there's a comment for you from another person in the chat here. And they say, thank you very much. Your voice and the way you speak is very tranquil and comforting. And Tony would like to ask you a question as well.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you, Chris. And thank you, Chris. Chris, I just want to continue on from pretty much the conversation we were just having, and even the point that Martha made about anchoring the breathing at the base of the nostril. I'm quite amazed that you've raised this, because I've had that very experience today in two meditation sessions, and it's only the second time this has happened to me. Normally, I find that I am consciously and perhaps with quite a bit of effort trying to maintain present focus on the breath at the base of the nostril, almost in a strenuous way. But today I noticed when I was meditating that my breath felt as if it had disappeared. And you, when you started talking about tranquility, that really resonated with the experience. And just to add to that, to give it some some depth of description, I suffer from anxiety, and I go through periods where I breathe, when I say periods, you know, literally weeks, sometimes months, where I find I'm a shallow breather, and my chest is tight. And I'm usually aware of that when I'm meditating as well, although I tend to sort of push it away. But today and tonight in this meditation, that completely, my chest opened up, my breathing opened up, my breathing disappeared again. Now for the question. Am I right to just allow that breath, as I'm describing it, to feel like it's disappeared, or do I have to bring myself back, in a sense, because I went quite deep because I was so calm. Do I need to come back and focus back on the breathing?
I would suggest that when you're talking about the breath disappearing, that's you're being aware of the tranquil breath. And because it doesn't have those ups and downs and trajectories of a normal in and out breath, and we're talking about it having the same qualitative awareness, same quality to it from moment to moment, it does have that illusion of disappearing.
Yeah.
But when you breathe like that, and it's, you know, it's really embraced. I don't want to be too much of a putting the cat amongst the pigeons, but it's sort of embracing shallow breathing, isn't it? Like it's allowing our breath to become as soft as it needs to, as tranquil as it needs to, and then we have a sense of effortlessness with it. It's like it's just the exact right moment, the exact right amount of breath in that moment, and it can sort of disappear. And for me, disappearing is comfort and is pleasure and happiness. So whilst still, you know, I recognize it as the breath, it doesn't appear like a normal breath. So a lot of people will describe it as the breath disappearing. But as long as you're continuing to be tranquil and your mind's continue to be radiant, you can usually be assured that, you know, you're concentrating on both the radiance of your mind and the subtle breath, sort of that in that reinforcing dynamic.
Yeah, Chris, just to add to that, just to clarify too, I was mindful that I was breathing, but it was almost as if I just knew I was breathing, and but it was just so smooth, so calm,
And I think, you know, that's why that, you know, description of, you know, one of the someone who was in the monastery for a little while described it as like his, you know, he felt like he was almost breathing underwater, like he was referring perhaps to something else. But that was, you know, it has that sense of just ease and comfort that's just supreme. And at that point, it's, you know, it's hard to identify any particular area of the body. So I don't personally anchor the breath anywhere. But when it, you know, if anything, I like some of the forest ajahns, like Ajahn Lee Dharmadaro, talking about, you know, being aware of his whole body while breathing and feeling light, and like one almost wants to levitate, or to describe like throwing a white sheet over his whole body, sort of this sort of perceptions that really, you know, a lot of his sort of descriptions really resonate with me. And he was considered like the ultimate master of breath meditation, really.
I think too, when you started talking about acknowledging the space around your body and your posture and that, I think that also helped in the sense of that lightness, creating that sense sort of triggered it for me, I guess.
Yeah, I think if we're trying to anchor it in a particular place, and it's okay, you know, but you don't want to have too much of a concrete sense of that. Like if I had to narrow it down to where I was focusing when the breath was very soft and gentle, it's possibly internal actually in the palate or something. But always you just go for wherever it's the most soft and delicate. You know, I don't try to have any sense of really where it is exactly. But, you know, if I've recreated now, then if anything, it just feels like that curvature from the back of your nose into the palate. But because we've got some very sensitive sense organs up there. But you can have a sense of your whole body feeling light and floaty, and you can put that because even if the feeling is here, you might feel that in your heart. Or like perception's an interesting thing. When we become calm, our perception will shift and generate and change. Thank you. That was a great question, because it's something that, you know, often people talk about in the forest tradition of the breath disappearing, and it's considered one of the drawbacks of breath meditation. People get confused at that point and don't know what to do. So it is some subtle vagaries with the breath. It's fascinating.
Thank you. It is fascinating. It's been absolutely fascinating point this evening. We have a question here. Could you kindly share how we can maintain a daily meditation practice as lay practitioners with duties and distractions?
Session. You know, it's not something that I've mastered. You know, I try to bring some of that quality into every day, but it's not necessarily in a formal meditation every day like I'd like to. But my best advice, and again, this is something that from the beginner to people who've been meditating for over 20 years, I find, for me anyway, and I'll give credit here to a little Tibetan book called Samatha Meditation that challenged my perception of having to sit for long periods with developing quality samadhi, with doing very sort of short meditations where the quality was very, very high in terms of our mind wandering, and then repeating that. And even though when I read that book, I found it interesting and I did it a little bit, I still ended up sitting for a long period. But having sort of sabotaged my point, not really. One of the things for me to be able to access meditation readily is to have a very low bar for how long I sit. So I will just, and it's some fun and spontaneity to it. If you've got a meditation cushion next to your TV or in your lounge next to you where you watch TV, you know, that's a favorite trick of mine. You know, I just will put it on a rug in front of where the lounge is, plop myself on it, and just see if I can have see how beautiful I can make my meditation in a short amount of time, or probably better to say allow my meditation to be in a short space of time. And you know, that's something that we can repeat numerous times a day, but by having the goal to do it at least once a day and having a very low bar of just like 5 minutes or so, but having that freedom around it, that, because you usually find after 5 minutes, not that you've set an alarm for 5 minutes, but you usually find that after a little while you're really enjoying it. You just want to go, keep going. And then you just will keep meditating until I find my quality starts to slip and my sense of really having that joy and happiness starts to dissipate. And then I'll, you know, get up, or maybe my cat will come and disturb me, as you heard. Sometimes he'll stand on my legs and meow in my face or something while I'm meditating. And then you realize the meditation's reached a natural conclusion. and then, you know, or my wife will call me to come and do the cat litter or something. And I feel a lot more relaxed about meditation now, whereas when I was a monk, you know, everyone knows that sound is a thorn in the first jhana, or whatever the saying is in the sutras. So people get very upset about sound, even though they're not in jhana. But this idea that sound is your enemy, you know, whereas I think, you know, we can not take ourselves too seriously and even try to have blissful meditation in the midst of sound. I remember a compactor once, or not an earth digger actually, right near my heart. But fortunately my meditation was going well, and I just thought, well, as long as the bliss outweighs the sound, it should be an okay meditation. So we can have that sense that even if our partner's blaring some, you know, some soapy or something in the other room, that we don't have to make an enemy out of it. We can just try to make our meditation as pleasant as possible, and they can peacefully coexist. So I think just by having that really relaxed approach, so we're removing the obstacles in our own mind to meditating in our homes, and we set a very low bar for sort of quantity, but we can focus on quality. Like, I don't do what this book suggests, but back in the day when I read it in the monastery, it was, I think it mentioned that if you find your mind wandering 3 times, it's usually, you know, it's shot, your meditation's shot then or something, which I wouldn't want to impose that idea on anyone, but the sense of, you know, just whilst you're sitting there, whilst you're having fun, whilst you're feeling tranquil, like maybe whilst, like Malcolm mentioned about having, feeling like his breath disappeared, and, you know, once that, those nice feelings have disappeared, and you know, you can go back to doing your day-to-day task. But why not have many more short meditations throughout the day, rather than sitting in a block that might not be appealing if you setting a time limit or setting a goal for yourself to sit for an hour or whatever, that might not be appealing enough to actually get you on the cushion. You might actively seek distractions to avoid the scenario. So we can sort of trick ourselves, and then if your meditation's going really well, by all means, sit as long as you want. Or if you're feeling inspired, or you're in a special place, you know, a beautiful temple, or, you know, there's always opportunities to deepen our practice or sit for longer. But maybe that should be linked with quality rather than just doing your time, so to speak, which is, you know, how I learned to meditate. And I'd have to do this counting technique 3 times, I think, was my goal. And it was really complex counting technique that Ajahn Brahm taught me. So usually, like, if I tried to complete that mindfully 3 times, I'd usually sit up for about an hour. But having said that, some of those little impromptu sits I had in the before the dana, when everyone's gathering, because as a junior monk, you don't have to talk to the lay people. And I would just, you know, get really blissed out in some really, you know, interesting settings, you know. So that's why I just encourage everyone just to maybe play with that idea of just having short little meditations and trying to make them good quality. And if you want to keep meditating and you don't have any duties, and by all means, you know, deepen your happiness. But yeah, that's my trick anyway, to try to get me on the cushion, you know, because we always forget. It's not like meditation goes against the grain, it goes against the flow of our sense desires. So it's not something that you will crave, even though your meditation experience could be more pleasurable than a cheesecake or what else do people like? I don't know, a cup of tea or a coffee or beautiful piece of music or a TV show. Your meditation actually, even at not even the best level, it's probably more pleasant than a lot of other activities in your day, but we don't have craving of sense desire for meditation. That'll never come up. It's not something that comes up for me. It's more just if you're getting, maybe when I was a monk and you're getting blissed out a lot, you start to really crave that feeling and you get it, you go for it as often as possible. But usually it's not something that we will habitually crave or seek out in our day-to-day practice. We do have to make that effort of at least getting on the cushion and striking our posture.
Well, Chris, on that note, I think we're coming near the end, but we have 2 people who have asked for further clarification. Could you repeat again who is considered the ultimate breath meditator? You mentioned the name of a forest monk.
Oh, yeah. So Tanajan Lee Dhammadharo. He's famous for writing a book called Keeping the Breath in Mind. He also has an autobiography that's full of strange type psychic experiences and Tudong experiences, so people might find that really interesting. But he was also one of the most trusted disciples of Lumpur Mun and one of the earlier disciples, and he was Ajahn Mun's attendant for a period of time, quite famous in the Thai forest tradition. But he died at a young age. He went and lived in the hill tribes up in the north of Thailand, and he probably got a rheumatic fever or something that damaged his heart. That would be my take on it, because he described having fevers and feeling like he was going to die up there. But then he survived, but then he died of heart problems in his early 50s in his monastery. I haven't visited, actually. It's one of the monasteries I really want to visit in Bangkok, is Wat Asokaram, which he set up. But yeah, there is, you know, there's something to be gained from going to some of these Kru Bajan or famous teachers' monasteries, even though they've passed away. I went to a monastery in Ayutthaya, a monk called Lumpur Pan, who's sort of way before, like, even the modern, maybe not way before, probably 150 years or maybe up to 200 years ago, I'm not sure. But I didn't see a lot of value necessarily in going to his monastery, but I went there and had amazing experience still do one of his chants today and feel like rapture and my hair standing on end whenever I do this chant. So you can have amazing experiences connecting with some of these Ajahns. And he was probably most famous for, he was widely considered to be King Asoka in a previous lifetime. So it's probably one of the things that Ajahn Lee Dhammadharo is famous for. But yeah, he's very down to earth, and he does have some breath, like a combination of breath and sweeping meditation for health in the body that I don't really practice. And he talks about different points of the breath that he moves his awareness to, but it's the more vague things of like feeling his body floating and being aware of the whole breath, breathing, and you know, and he's just an inspiring monk in general, but he is considered like a bit of the expert on breath meditation in that Thai forest tradition. Yeah, thank you, everybody. It's been my privilege to be with amongst you tonight, meditating with you and sharing our journey on the path together. So thank you.